Hello, this is William Fink, and this is Christigenia Internet Radio. My record didn't start right away, which was why I had a slight delay, and I pray that the connection problems I had at 8 p.m. this evening are now past us. Today is Friday, September 3rd, 2022. Praise Yahweh, the God of Israel, and thank you for listening. This evening, we are going to present Part 25 of our commentary on the revelation of Yahshua Christ, and this is titled Violence of the Lambs, as I said last week. As it is described in the vision of Revelation chapter 18, at the fall of Babylon, the children of Israel, who are the exclusive people of Yahweh God, are called to come out of her and to separate themselves, whereupon they are told to return to her as she also had rendered, and you double twice the things according to her works, as much as she had magnified herself and lived wantonly, so much you give torment and grief to her. So it is fully evident that according to the revelation, the children of Israel shall indeed have a role in executing the vengeance of Yahweh God upon his enemies. As we have already said in relation to this, Paul of Tarsus had also made the same expression to the Corinthians, where he had written in his second epistle in chapter 10, telling them, "For the arms of our warfare are not fleshly, but through Yahweh they are able to destroy strongholds, destroying reasonings and every bulwark raising itself up against the knowledge of Yahweh, and taking captive every thought into the obedience of the anointed, also being in readiness to avenge all disobedience whenever you shall have fulfilled your obedience." Paul of Tarsus wrote that epistle perhaps 40 years before John recorded this revelation of Yahshua Christ, and must have had his own understanding from the words of the Old Testament prophets, with whom this revelation certainly agrees, magnifies, and augments. With this, we may understand that before Babylon falls, Christians must constrain themselves to fighting for the hearts and minds of their own people, so that they do not worship the beast. But then, being obedient to the commandments of Christ, once Babylon does fall, then Christians shall indeed have a part in the execution of God's will against his enemies. So while Revelation chapter 19 began with a description of the bride preparing herself for the marriage supper of the Lamb, that preparation is evidently fulfilled as the children of Israel come out of Babylon and turn to obedience in Christ. The Word of God offers no path to redemption other than repentance and separation from the wicked society. But evidently, Yahweh God also informs us that such a separation cannot be successful until the society itself crumbles. This situation leads us to conclude that coming out of Babylon truly entails the separation of Christian Israel from all other peoples, since they are not of God, and they themselves, not having the Spirit of God, are little but beasts. This is evident in the epistles of the apostles. For example, as it is in the King James Version, the apostle Jude wrote to his Christian readers that they should earnestly contend for the faith which was once delivered unto the saints, their ancestors, those Old Testament saints. Then he immediately warned them concerning infiltrators, men who were already condemned by God, which he went on to relate to the Nephilim, or fallen angels. Following that, he described them further, and he wrote, "But these speak evil of those things which they know not. But what they know naturally, as brute beasts, in those things they corrupt themselves." With this, he also related their behavior to the way of Cain and to the error of Balaam, both of which were related to race-mixing fornication, and then to the gainsaying of Korah, who had sought to establish his own order of priests, contrary to the instructions which Moses had received from Yahweh, and for that he was punished severely. Not ending there, Jude had explained that these beasts were already living among Christians in his own time, where he wrote, using the present tense, "These are spots in your feasts of charity, when they feast with you, feeding themselves without fear. Clouds they are without water, carried about of winds. Trees whose fruit withers." The tree is known by its fruit. They don't have any. It withers. "Without fruit, twice dead, plucked up by the roots. Raging waves of the sea foaming out of their own shame. Wandering stars to whom is reserved the blackness of darkness forever." So the apostle described a race related to the Nephilim, the fallen angels, the angels which left their first estate, which was already scattered among first century Christians, that they would infiltrate and corrupt Christian communities, and that their fate is the blackness of darkness forever, which is similar to the fate of the fallen angels described elsewhere in Scripture. In chapter 2 of his own epistle, his second epistle, the Apostle Peter warned us of the same infiltrators using very similar language, and described them as natural brute beasts made to be taken and destroyed, who speak evil of the things that they understand not, and shall utterly perish in their own corruption, and shall receive the reward of unrighteousness, as they that count it pleasure to riot in the daytime. Spots they are, and blemishes, sporting themselves with their own deceivings while they feast with you, having eyes full of adultery, that cannot cease from sin, beguiling unstable souls, and a heart they have exercised with covetous practices. Cursed children. And we will stop there. Where Peter continues, he also associates them with the race-mixing fornication of Balaam, continuing to warn his readers. In his first epistle to the Corinthians, in chapter 10, Paul of Tarsus explained that such fornication was the sin of the event which resulted from the counsel of Balaam, which is also evident here in Revelation chapter 2. Nothing which Yahweh had created was made simply to be taken and destroyed, but rather everything which he created was good. But every corruption of his creation is worthy to be destroyed, for which reason, in that same chapter of the Revelation, Yahshua Christ had promised to kill the children of the fornicators. So the violence of the Lamb is a just and righteous violence, and his judgment is coming. Furthermore, the cursed children mentioned by Peter are the children of Cain and Canaan and Esau, since Yahweh God promised to bless the children of Israel. And as Paul wrote concerning the scattered children of Israel in Galatians chapter 3, Christ has redeemed us from the curse of the law, becoming a curse on our behalf, as it is written, "Accursed is everyone who hangs upon a timber," or a tree, if you will, in order that the blessing of Abraham would come to the nations at the hand of Christ Yahshua, and that we should receive the promise of the Spirit through the faith. Paul clarified his meaning in chapter 4 of that epistle, where he wrote, "And when the fulfillment of the time had come, Yahweh had dispatched his son, having been born of a woman, having been subject to law, in order that he would redeem those subject to law, that we would recover the position of sons." Not that other people would recover the position of sons, people that had no part with the law. Elsewhere in Romans chapter 9, Paul explained that this same position of sons, or adoption, as it is in many popular translations, as well as the law itself, is only for the true children of Israel, as opposed to the Edomites and other Canaanites in Judea who were calling themselves Israel. You can't just simply call yourself Israel and be Israel, even if you're a early Roman Catholic. It doesn't work, unless you're descended from the 12 tribes of Israel. Those nations to whom the promise would come can only be the nations which Abraham was promised would come from his seed, as Paul wrote in Romans chapter 4, in part, "Therefore, from of the faith, that in accordance with favor, then the promise is to be certain to all of the offspring," or seed, if you will, "not to that of the law only, but also to that of the faith of Abraham, who is the father of us all." Now, Paul isn't saying it's one or the other. He's basically saying it's both, because Christ came to redeem those who were under the law. He didn't come to redeem anybody who was not under the law. "Just as it is written, that a father of many nations I have made you, before Yahweh whom he trusted, who raises the dead to life, and calls things not existing as existing." In other words, he named those nations before they existed, but they did come from Abraham's seed. "Who, contrary to expectation, in expectation believed, for which he would become a father of many nations, according to the declaration, thus your offspring will be." And that is the faith of Abraham, defined by Paul of Tarsus. The faith of Abraham, the Christian faith, isn't what you believe, it's what Abraham believed. As Paul explains in that passage, the nations are reckoned by what faith Abraham had, not from what faith anybody else may have or may not believe. And Abraham had believed that his offspring would become those many nations. Abraham never believed that other nations would somehow become his offspring. But the churches have been spreading that lie for over 1,800 years, in spite of the fact that it is not what either Moses or Paul had written. Within the historical context of first century Judea, speaking of cursed children, brute beasts, and spots in your feast of charity, the apostles Jude and Peter could only have been referring to the mixed race Edomites and Canaanites spread throughout the region, who had descended in part from both Canaan, and the ancient Nephilim. After the time of Christ, not having accepted the gospel, these became known collectively, for the most part, as Jews. Christ himself described them in his parable of the tares of the field, describing people who were sown by the devil. When he gave that parable, as it is recorded in Matthew chapter 13, his disciples did not understand it. So when they asked him to explain, we read that responding he said, "He sowing the good seed is the Son of Man. Now the field is the world, and the good seed, these are the sons of the kingdom. But the tares are the sons of the evil one, and the enemy who sows them is the devil. And the harvest is the consummation of the age, and the reapers are the messengers. Therefore, just as the tares are gathered and burn in the fire, thusly it shall be at the consummation of the age." Many Christian commentators have correctly remarked that Joshua, the son of Nun, served in various ways as a type for another Joshua, who was Yahshua Christ. But they fail to describe the entirety of such a type. In the history of Joshua in Canaan, the successor to Moses was told to lead the children of Israel to completely extinguish all of the Canaanites in the land, to kill them all, a task which he, being a man, had failed to complete before he died. Subsequently, the children of Israel failed to fulfill the command, left many of the Canaanites in various places unharmed, and for that they were told, as it is recorded in Numbers chapter 33, "But if you will not drive out the inhabitants of the land from before you, then it shall come to pass that those which you let remain of them shall be pricks in your eyes and thorns in your sides, and shall vex you in the land wherein you dwell." Ultimately, Yahweh did punish the children of Israel and have them taken out of the land as he had warned them at that early time. Although Joshua the son of Nun had failed to destroy all of the enemies of Yahweh during the conquest of Canaan, the scope of Yahshua Christ at his promised return is much greater, since now the children of Israel cover not only Canaan, but the entire planet, as the promises to Abraham that they would become many nations and be spread abroad have long been fulfilled. This fulfillment was professed by Paul of Tarsus in several of his epistles, and especially in Romans chapter 4. So while it can also be demonstrated from ancient history that white Europeans have indeed descended predominantly from the ancient children of Israel, wherever they dwell today, they are vexed by those same Edomites and Canaanites of which they had been warned. But today they are vexed by these people who are found by other names, such as Jews and Arabs and even Mexicans or Hispanics, among other races who descended from the ancient Nephilim. While Joshua had failed, men often fail, but Yahshua Christ, being Yahweh God incarnate, shall not fail. Therefore, Christ himself had professed in the parable of the sheep and the goats, which is recorded in Matthew chapter 25. "And when the Son of Man should come in his effulgence, and all the messengers with him, then he shall sit upon the throne of his throne of honor." I almost said the throne of his honor, which is cool. "And they shall gather before him all the nations, and he shall separate them one from another, just as the shepherd separates the sheep from the goats." So all nations, not churches or groups of believers and unbelievers, but nations, are separated as a shepherd does the sheep from the goats, which is by their appearance and not by any inquiry into a particular animal's behavior or profession of faith. Sheep are sheep, and goats are goats, regardless of what they could possibly do or what they may think about themselves. Sheep can't identify as goats any more than men can identify as women. Continuing with the parable, "And he shall indeed stand the sheep at his right hand, but the goats at his left hand. Then the king, Christ himself, shall say to those at his right hand, 'Come, those blessed of my Father,'" those sheep who are sheep by their appearance, "'you shall inherit the kingdom which has been prepared for you from the foundation of society. For I hungered, and you gave me to eat, and I had thirst, and you had given me drink. I was a visitor, and you had taken me in. Naked, and you had clothed me. I had been sick, and you watched over me. I was in prison, and you had come to me.' Then the righteous shall respond to him, saying, 'Master, when have we seen you hungry and nourished you, or thirsting and had given you drink? And when have we seen you a visitor and had taken you in, or naked and had clothed you? And when have we seen you being sick or in prison and had come to you?' And replying, the king shall say to them, 'Truly I say to you, for whomever of the least of my brethren,'" so the sheep are his brethren, "'have you done one of these things, you have done them for me.'" As Paul said, he took upon himself the flesh of Abraham so that he could be made like the brethren in the epistle to the Hebrews. In chapter 2, I believe. This is from memory. as the Apostle John had also taught in his epistles. Christians demonstrate their own worthiness by keeping the commandments of Christ and by loving their own brethren, which is all that Christ himself had commanded them. If all sins are forgiven, as Yahweh God has promised, then any act of good will, of goodwill towards one's brethren may be interpreted as a deed, a good deed, worthy of at least some reward in the kingdom of heaven. As Paul also described in 1 Corinthians chapter 3, where he wrote that the work of each will become evident. Indeed, the day will disclose it, because in fire it is revealed. And of what quality the work of each is, the fire will scrutinize. If the work of anyone who is built remains, he will receive a reward. If the work of anyone burns completely, he will suffer loss. But he himself will be preserved, although consequently through fire, as long as he's written into the book of life. Paul was only talking to white Christians, people who were, who he was confident were written into the book of life. Continuing once more with the parable, the sheep and the goats. Then he shall say also to those at the left hand, to the goats, go from me, accursed, into the eternal fire, just because they looked like goats, for no other reason. They were separated by what they looked like, not by what they did or what they believed. Go from me, accursed, into the eternal fire, which has been prepared for the false accuser, or the devil, and his messengers, the fallen angels, and their offspring, who are the tares of the field. For I hungered, and you did not give me to eat, and I thirst, and you had not given me drink. I was a visitor, and you had not taken me in. Naked, and you had not clothed me. Sick and in prison, and you had not visited me. Then they themselves shall also respond, saying, Master, when have we seen you hungry, or thirsting, or a visitor, or naked, or sick in prison, and had not served you? Then he shall respond to them, saying, truly I say to you, for whatever you have not done for one of the least of these, neither have you done them for me. And they shall go off into the eternal punishment, but the righteous into eternal life. The sheep are righteous because of their appearance, because of their race. They're sheep. They're not goats trying to pose as sheep. The goats are doomed simply because of their own race or species. They're goats. And this does not mean that the goats shall be judged well if their behavior is good. It means that the goats are judged for how they may have treated the sheep, not one another, the least of these being a reference to the sheep. If they failed in one act of charity towards the sheep, they have failed completely. But even their very presence among the sheep is also a violation of Yahweh's law, because we're not really talking about sheep and goats, we're really talking about people. So there is no manner in which the goats could possibly do good, and in the end, they shall all be destroyed. As the parable explains, the goats are nations, and all of the goats are condemned in that same fire prepared for the devil and his angels. As we interpret the later portion of Revelation chapter 19, and also the parallel vision in chapter 20, we shall interpret that event in a manner which reconciles this prophecy with many similar descriptions found in the words of the prophets. Up to this point, I should say, we shall interpret these events. I don't have a proofreader. It's impossible to proofread this before I present it and post it at Christogenia. Up to this point in this chapter, we have seen the announcement of the wedding feast of the Lamb, the purpose of that feast for the children of Israel as it was described in the words of the prophets, and the proclamation that the bride has prepared herself, ostensibly by coming out from the fallen state of mystery Babylon. So we paused our commentary at verse 9, where we read, and he says to me, "Ride. Blessed are those invited to the dinner of the wedding feast of the Lamb." And he says to me, "These are true words from Yahweh." According to those same prophets, and according to Christ, who said, "I have not been sent except to the lost sheep of the house of Israel." Only the children of Israel are invited to that feast. Now we shall commence with Revelation chapter 19, from where we left off in verse 10. "And I fell before his feet to worship him. And he says to me, 'No, look, I am your fellow servant and of your brethren who have the testimony of Yahshua. Worship Yahweh, for the testimony of Yahshua is the spirit of interpreting prophecy.'" As Paul of Tarsus had written in Hebrews chapter 1, and this is long before the Revelation, Paul wrote the epistles to the Hebrews in 57 AD, maybe 58 AD, I think I have. So the Revelation was written in 96 AD, maybe 95, by John. That's almost 40 years. And Paul said of prophecy, in the sense of revealing and announcing the will of God to man, that Yahshua Christ is the last prophet. However, as Liddell and Scott explain, the Greek word prophetia is primarily the gift of interpreting the will of the gods in the profane Greek writings, and therefore it is the gift of interpreting the will of God, which Paul had also professed. Here it is translated in that manner as interpreting prophecy. The word has one other use in the New Testament, which is the ability to reveal things which are not generally known or known by any apparent means to the person who can reveal them, to reveal secrets that you should not otherwise know. You better know what you're doing if you're going to try doing that, because people go down in flames doing that all the time. Here, the messenger or angel with whom John had interacted, and to whom he had apparently sought to do homage, must be the same angel described at the beginning of chapter 17, as the context is not broken from that point, where we read, "And one from among the seven messengers, having the seven bowls, came and spoke with me, saying," and that same angel took him to witness the whore in the wilderness, or desert, as we have it here. While we do not know the precise identity or status of the angel, as the word refers merely to a messenger, and not to a peculiar race or creature, here, the messenger describes himself as a man and also as one of John's own brethren. So we cannot imagine it to be anything ethereal. But this may also assist in the understanding another obscure aspect of Scripture, that the messengers or angels who are gathered to Christ at the time of his return are also like this angel, who professed that he was one of John's brethren, meaning that he too must have been of the children of Israel. While we cannot see the future, and while what Paul of Tarsus meant specifically is debatable, because the language is enigmatic, this passage leads one to consider Paul's words in 1 Corinthians chapter 15, where he wrote, "Behold, I tell you a mystery. We shall not all fall asleep," meaning die, "but we shall all be changed. In an instant, in a dart of an eye, with the last trumpet, for it shall sound, and the dead shall be raised incorruptible, and we shall be changed." The subsequent description of the incorruptible man, which he made in that chapter, is very similar to statements in the final chapters of the Revelation. Perhaps I will remember to correlate some of them. when we do our commentary on Revelation chapters 21 and 22. Now we're in chapter 19 at verse 11. And I saw the heaven having been opened, and behold, a white horse, and he sitting upon it called Faithful and True, and he judges in righteousness and makes war. And originally that word called was left out of the text of the Christogenean New Testament purposely, as the 27th edition of the Nestle Aland Novum Testamentum Graece marks it as doubtful. The 28th edition retains the marking. The word is wanting in the Codex Alexandrinus and the majority text manuscripts following Andreas of Caesarea, but it is present in the Codex Sinaiticus and the traditional manuscripts of the majority text, although the word order is slightly different. Here we have chosen to include the word. And let me state that, and this is not in my notes, it's a digression, that throughout this commentary, and because it so often, not always, but so often agrees with the ancient papyri, as opposed to the Codex Alexandrinus, my stock or my esteem for the Book of Revelation, as it appears in the Codex Sinaiticus, has been elevated. Let me put it that way. It has increased. So the Codex Sinaiticus, in its copy of Revelation, it is defective in places where there are clear errors, and I've discussed a lot of those here. However, where it isn't defective, it is actually, I believe, a lot closer to the ancient papyri than the Codex Alexandrinus is, and my stock in it throughout the course of these presentations has actually increased somewhat. So that's all I have to say about that for now. Perhaps someday I'll do an even deeper study and detail those reasons. Someday, if I live maybe as long as Clifton did. In other words, I would need another 30 years. In Revelation chapter 6, we read of a white horse, and he's sitting upon it having a bow. And a crown has been given to him, and he went out conquering, and that he may conquer. So in our commentary for that passage, we said in part that we may view the white horse as symbolizing the expansion of Rome, Yahweh God having prophesied of the Roman Empire as early as the days of Daniel. The crown on the white horse was bestowed by God, whether for better or for worse. Here that interpretation is corroborated, that the conqueror on a white horse has the blessings of God. But now it is Yahshua Christ himself, Yahweh God incarnate, upon the white horse where he is setting out to destroy his enemies and to establish his own kingdom. So now it continues to describe him in verse 12. Now his eyes are as flames of fire, and upon his head are many diadems, having a name inscribed, which no one knows except him. And he is cloaked with a garment dipped in blood, and his name is called the Word of Yahweh. The Word of Yahweh, Yahshua Christ, is the Word made flesh. The same word of which the very first utterance recorded in Genesis chapter 1 had been, "Let there be light." And that light was also an indication of the presence of Yahweh God in the world, an early announcement of the gospel of Christ as the light come into the world. He being the Word made flesh is God the Word, which came to men in order to keep his promises of redemption and salvation for Israel, and also the promises of Genesis, which were made to the entire Adamic race, to the man created by God, as opposed to the corruptions of those who have been rebelling, who have been rebelling, who have rebelled against him. Yes, they're still rebelling. A garment dipped in blood. To this vision, we may compare the harvest of both the parched and the ripe grapes in Revelation chapter 14. And also a prophecy, a related prophecy, where in Isaiah chapter 63, Yahweh himself promised to destroy his enemies, the Edomites, and his garments are covered with their blood. There we read, "Who is this that cometh from Edom, with thy garments from Bozrah? This that is glorious in his apparel, traveling in the greatness of his strength. I did speak in righteousness, mighty to save." Yahweh answering his own question, because this should be presented as a dialogue, but the texts never really do that. "Wherefore art thou red in thine apparel, and thy garments like him that treadeth in a wine fat?" And then he answer, "I have trodden the winepress alone, and of the people there was none with me. For I will tread them in mine anger, and trample them in my fury. And their blood shall be sprinkled upon my garments, and I will stain all my raiment," the garment dipped in blood. "For the day of vengeance is in my heart, and the year of my redeemed is come." That same day of vengeance is described here in Revelation chapter 19, when it shall finally be fulfilled. "And upon his head are many diadems." These diadems, or crowns, which is easier to pronounce, seem to represent the previous announcement of the angel who had sounded the seventh trumpet in Revelation chapter 11 and said, "The kingdom of the society of our prince and of his anointed has come, and he shall rule for the eternal ages." The text, the Greek has kingdom, the King James Version has kingdoms. I don't know why. So now Christ is pictured symbolically as wearing the crowns of all the former kingdoms because he is the true king. This also helps indicate this last part of the revelation represents a lengthy process rather than a series of singular events. But each of those kingdoms had already belonged to Christ once the peoples of Europe had accepted Christianity, which is evident in Daniel chapter 2 at verse 44, where it explains that the kingdom established by God shall break in pieces and consume all previous worldly kingdoms. And that will also help us to interpret a similar reference in Revelation chapter 20. However, we will leave it for that time. Verse 14. "And the armies in heaven follow him upon white horses, clothed with clean white linen." These are evidently those who had followed the call to come out of her, my people, once Babylon had fallen. In that, the bride prepares herself for the marriage supper of the Lamb. And we read earlier in this chapter that it is given to her that she is wrapped in clean, bright linen, for the linen is the vindications of the saints. So here it is those same saints who are described as being gathered to Christ and following behind him. From a similar aspect, the Apostle Jude cited the writings of Enoch in verse 14 of his epistle, where he wrote, "And Enoch, seventh from Adam, prophesied to thee, saying, Behold, the prince has come with 10,000s of his saints, to execute judgment against all, and to convict every soul for all of their impious deeds, which they committed impiously, and for all of the harsh things which the impious wrongdoers have spoken against him." There we must also see that the saints, or sanctified ones, who are the children of Israel, are the angels who shall accompany Christ and take a part in the execution of his vengeance. Moving to verse 14. "And a sharp sword comes out from of his mouth, in order that with it He may smite the nations, and he shall shepherd them with an iron staff, and he shall trample the vat of the wine of the wrath of the anger of Yahweh Almighty. And he has upon his garment and upon his thigh a name written, King of Kings and Sovereign of Sovereigns, or Prince of Princes, if you will. I took pains to distinguish all of these titles from the word Lord, which I perceived all my life was very much abused by most denominational Christians, if not all. This evokes the closing lines of the Song of Moses found in Deuteronomy. And by this, we are once again assured as to which Song of Moses is referred to in Revelation chapter 15, where it is also described as the Song of the Lamb. So we read in Deuteronomy chapter 32, "If I whet my glittering sword, and mine hand take hold on judgment, I will render vengeance to mine enemies and will reward them that hate me. I will make mine arrows drunk with blood, and my sword shall devour flesh, and that the blood of the slain and of the captives from the beginning of revenges upon the enemy." There are several prophecies which indicate that the children of Israel shall be besieged by people of other races at the day of Yahweh's wrath. And this is also described in Revelation chapter 20. Among them are Jeremiah chapter 31, verses 27 through 30. "Behold, the days come, saith Yahweh, that I will sow the house of Israel and the house of Judah with the seed of man and with the seed of beast. And it shall come to pass that like as I have watched over them to pluck up and to break down and to throw down and to destroy and to afflict, so will I watch over them to build and to plant, saith Yahweh. In those days they shall say no more, the fathers have eaten the sour grape and the children's teeth are set on edge. But everyone shall die for his own iniquity. Every man that eats the sour grape, his teeth shall be set on edge." Look around you. If someone is not a child of Adam, then he must be a beast. And I'm not ashamed of that. That's just a fact of God's creation. Because Jeremiah wasn't talking about cats and dogs or lions and tigers. Man wouldn't sin. Well, at least most men wouldn't sin with cats, dogs, lions, and tigers. But man sins all the time with two-legged beasts, and their teeth shall be set on edge. These words were uttered immediately preceding an explicit promise of the new covenant, which, as we have already explained, is not yet fully consummated and will not be consummated until after the fall of Babylon and this wedding feast of the Lamb. So it should be evident that the current world situation, where all sorts of alien beasts have been flooding into the lands of the nations of Christendom, is a judgment from Yahweh. However, just as Yahweh had used the Assyrians and the Babylonians to chastise the children of Israel in ancient times, and then punish the Assyrians and the Babylonians, so shall he punish these beasts, which are presently flooding Israelite lands. The prophet Isaiah also corroborates for us the fact that these are indeed beasts, where he wrote in Isaiah chapter 56, "All ye beasts of the field, come to devour, yeah, all ye beasts in the forest. His watchmen are blind, the pastors. They are all ignorant. They are all dumb dogs. They cannot bark, sleeping, lying down, loving to slumber. Yeah, they are greedy dogs, which can never have enough. And they are shepherds that cannot understand. They all looked to their own way, every one for his gain from his quarter. While the children of Israel are suffering this judgment from Yahweh, it is the watchmen of Israel who have allowed this to happen. Rather than teaching scripture, they have tailored false doctrines to satisfy the needs of the merchants of Mystery Babylon, seeking to fill their own bellies rather than guarding the true flock of God. So they have IRS tax exemptions, Lamborghinis, and jet planes. With this, it may also become apparent that the destruction of ancient Israel is a type for the circumstances of today, as the same historical patterns have been followed, where Israel sought to enrich herself through global trade with the heathen nations. But those nations ultimately destroy Israel. They did it then, they're doing it now. So in the 79th Psalm, which reflects the attitude of a repentant Israel already in captivity, it is evident once again that for this, the wrath of Yahweh is upon those nations. There we read in verse 1, and we won't read the entire psalm, but a significant portion. O God, the nations, I'm not going to read the word heathen. They are nations. Now, even if they describe non-Israel nations, the word literally means nations, and that's what I will read. The King James Version was very arbitrary in its translations of goy or ethnos as nation or heathen. Goy being the Hebrew word, ethnos being the Greek word. O God, the nations are come into thine inheritance. Thy holy temple, meaning the children of Israel as a whole, for real, thy holy temple they have defiled. They have laid Jerusalem on heaps. The dead bodies of thy servants have they given to be meat unto the fowls of heaven, the flesh of thy saints unto the beasts of the earth. Their blood have they shed like water round about Jerusalem, and there was none to bury them. Later in this chapter of the Revelation, the birds of heaven are depicted eating the flesh of the enemies rather than the flesh of Israel. Continuing with the psalm for two more verses. No, we probably have another paragraph. I'm sorry. We are become a reproach to our neighbors, a scorn and derision to them that are round about us. How long, Lord, or how long, Yahweh, wilt thou be angry forever? Shall thy jealousy burn like fire? Once again, white Christians are a scorn and a derision to their heathen neighbors, and open hatred of whites is fully apparent in the world's media, government policy, and schools. Continuing again in the 79th Psalm from verse 6, pour out thy wrath upon the nations that have not known thee. That's every other nation except the children of Israel. And upon the kingdoms that have not called upon thy name. For they have devoured Jacob and laid waste his dwelling place. O, remember not against us former iniquities. Let thy tender mercy speedily prevent us, for we are brought very low. Help us, O God of our salvation, for the glory of thy name, and deliver us. And purge away our sins for thy name's sake, not for our sake, because we'll just sin again. Wherefore should the nations say, where is their God? Let him be known among the nations in our sight by the revenging of the blood of thy servants, which is shed. In Amos chapter 3, verse 2, it is stated explicitly that Yahweh has only known the children of Israel, but that they must be punished for their iniquities, which is the reason for the captivities. Here in Revelation chapter 19, and in Revelation chapter 6, I'm sorry, the souls of the children of Israel depicted as being under the altar before the throne of God are also described as crying out to God that he avenge their blood against those dwelling upon the earth. The final verses of the psalm. Let the sighing of the prisoner come before thee. According to the greatness of thy power, preserve those that are appointed to die. Maybe I am reading this whole psalm. I think so. Confusing it with another I have in these notes. And render unto our neighbors sevenfold into their bosom their reproach, wherewith they have reproached thee, O Yahweh. So we thy people and sheep of thy pasture will give thee thanks forever. We will show forth thy praise to all generations. Those who were appointed to die were Israel as prisoners in captivity. They are the children of Israel who were liable under the law of the adulterous wife, but who now have mercy through Christ, as Paul had explained in Romans chapter 7. While this psalm described the state of Israel in captivity, it just as aptly describes the state of the children of Israel today as their neighbors devour them. As a digression, even among identity Christians, and they're probably the majority of identity Christians, in my opinion, but we're going to change that. Even among identity Christians, there is a false theology, which we call dominion theology. It was popularized in the British Israel movement over 100 years ago to give the British Empire a veneer of legitimacy. But they are absolute fools to think that the kingdom of heaven consists of the sons of Adam ruling over the non-Adamic so-called peoples with the laws of our God. As if natural brute beasts made to be taken and destroyed could actually ever understand or abide in his law. This is also reflected in the failed missionary pursuits of the past 500 years, where there has been no true progress regardless of the resources, the enormous resources, which are poured into certain impoverished nations. It is a doctrine designed to promote the preservation of devils, as if empathy for the devil was ever edifying to the assembly of God. The children of Israel being the sheep of Yahweh's pasture, as both David and Asaph had professed in several of the Psalms, Christ had informed them, as it is recorded in Matthew chapter 7, that you should not give that which is holy to the dogs. Nor should you cast your pearls before swine, lest they shall trample them with their feet, and turning, they would rend you to pieces. Therefore we must ask, can the nature of the swine or the dogs ever change? Does a leper change its spots? Do goats ever become sheep? Should Yahshua Christ ever change his admonition? Of course not, since he does not change. As Paul had professed in Hebrews chapter 13, Yahshua Christ the same, yesterday, today, and for the ages. Do not be carried away with strange and diverse teachings, for the good heart is confirmed by favor, not foods, by those who walk have no advantage, by which those who walk have no advantage, speaking about food sacrificed to idols. So we read in the 147th Psalm, which in the Septuagint is attributed, not in the King James Version, but in the Septuagint, is attributed to the prophets Haggai and Zechariah, where it is speaking of Yahweh God. He showeth his word unto Jacob, his statutes and his judgments unto Israel. He has not dealt so with any nation. And as for his judgments, they have not known them. Praise ye Yahweh. The prophets were joyful and praised God that only Israel had the law, and Paul of Tarsus had also affirmed that fact in Romans chapter 9. It is also affirmed in the words of Christ in the same parable of the sheep and the goats, where Christ explained that only sheep nations shall remain, and only sheep nations will be shepherded with a rod of iron, which is his law. Returning to this passage in Revelation chapter 19, in verse 15, we have read that Christ shall trample the vat of the wine of the wrath of the anger of Yahweh Almighty. As we have also explained, the visions in these seven chapters of the Revelation, chapters 14 through 20, are all parallelisms, as they each describe different aspects of the same events of the last days from various perspectives. So the trampling of the wine vat mentioned in verse 15 represents those same harvests of the parched and then of the ripe grapes, which are described in Revelation chapter 14. Now we must also note that the word of Yahweh God in his prophets had also foreseen the controversy of this very age. I should say the major, because there are others, the major controversy of this very age. The apostles of Christ taught that the 12 tribes scattered abroad, mainly in Europe and Anatolia, were true Israel, along with the remnants in Judea and Mesopotamia. In the words of Peter, Paul, and James. But from the second century, when so-called replacement theology began to develop in Judea, because it first appears in the words of Justin Martyr, and especially with the formation of the Roman Catholic Church in the fourth century, the church had claimed to be Israel and forgot the 12 tribes, or desperately sought to forget them. But they did not claim to be Israel in the true and biblical national sense of the word. Now in modern times, from the 19th century especially, the Jews have asserted that only they are Israel, and have been engaged in setting up a false Israeli state in Palestine in order to assert and maintain that claim. This is found in Isaiah chapter 34, in another explicit promise of the vengeance of Yahweh. But first it must be explained, as we shall also assert when we discuss Obadiah in this context, that this prophecy in Isaiah chapter 34 has never been fulfilled. Edom was never destroyed by the Assyrians, Babylonians, or Persians, or Romans. Well, they were partially destroyed by the Romans under the label of Judeans, but they weren't Edomites. Or they weren't calling themselves Edomites. They were Edomites, but they weren't calling themselves Edomites. They were calling themselves Judeans. Edom was never destroyed by the Assyrians, Babylonians, or Persians. The Edomites were tributaries subject to Israel and Judah from the time of David, and quickly allied themselves with the Assyrians, and in turn, the Babylonians, in order to free themselves from Israel. After the captivity of Judah, the Edomites migrated northward into the lands left vacant by the deportations. Then, in the second century before Christ, as Paul, Strabo, and Flavius Josephus all attest, the Edomites were converted to Judaism and became known as Judeans. The Israelites who accepted Christ lost their identity as Judeans, and those who rejected him became mingled with the Edomites, who were left behind to become known as Jews. We cannot repeat all of the historical details here, but we have explained the creation of the Jewish people elsewhere. So with that understanding, we shall read Isaiah chapter 34, in part. Come near, ye nations, to hear, and hearken, ye people. Let the earth hear, and all that is therein, the world, and all things that come forth of it. This is the gathering of all nations at the time of Yahweh's vengeance. And ostensibly, I should say this is a description of the gathering, if I wanted to be more technically precise. And ostensibly, they're being gathered into Israelite lands, which are now the nations of modern Christendom. So continuing with Isaiah, "For the indignation of Yahweh is upon all nations, and his fury upon all their armies. He has utterly destroyed them. He has delivered them to the slaughter." Of course, they aren't destroyed yet. He's naming something as being before it has been, because if they were already destroyed, he wouldn't be saying, "Come near, ye nations, to hear." "Their slain also shall be," future tense now, "shall be cast out, and their stink shall come up out of their carcasses, and the mountains shall be melted with their blood, and all the host of heaven shall be dissolved, and the heavens shall be rolled together as a scroll, and all their hosts shall fall down, as the leaf falls off from the vine, and as a falling fig from the fig tree." Paul alluded to this passage in reference to Christ in Hebrews chapter 1, verses 11 and 12. The hosts of heaven here seem to refer to the world governments, the governments of the children of Israel, which are joined to the beast. The mountains are the nations in general, and not literal mountains. Literal mountains don't have blood. There is also similar language in parallel prophecies in Ezekiel chapter 38 and 39. For example, in Ezekiel 38:16, we read of all the nations gathered against the mountains of Israel, that they shall come up against my people as a cloud to cover the land. It shall be in later days, and I will bring thee against my land, that the nations of Israel, may know me when I shall be sanctified in thee, O Gog, before their eyes. But the mountains of Israel are not necessarily the mountains which the children of Israel may inhabit. Rather, we read in Ezekiel chapter 36, "Also, thou son of man, prophesy unto the mountains of Israel, and say, Ye mountains of Israel, hear the word of Yahweh," where mountains must represent the nations of the tribes of Israel. Parallels with Ezekiel chapters 38 and 39, and these chapters of the Revelation, shall be addressed further as we progress through this commentary, as they relate more directly to the vision of the camp of the saints in Revelation chapter 20. Continuing again with Isaiah chapter 34, "For my sword shall be bathed in heaven. Behold, it shall come down upon Edomia, and upon the people of my curse to judgment." So the Edomites are at least one of the accursed people, the people of Yahweh's curse. "And the sword of Yahweh is filled with blood. It is made fat with fatness, and with the blood of lambs and goats, with the fat of the kidneys of rams. For Yahweh has a sacrifice in Bozrah, and a great slaughter in the land of Edomia. And the unicorns shall come down with them, and the bullocks with the bulls, and their land shall be soaked with blood, and their dust made fat with fatness. For it is the day of Yahweh's vengeance, and the year of recompenses for the controversy of Zion. And the streams thereof shall be turned into pitch, and the dust thereof into brimstone, and the land thereof shall become burning pitch. It shall not be quenched night nor day. The smoke thereof shall go up forever. From generation to generation it shall lie waste. None shall pass through it forever and ever." Here we would assert that Bozrah and Edom are representative of the people of the Edomites, the modern Jews, and not of the ancient geographical places, which throughout history have practically been desolate in modern times. As we also said, here it is fully evident that the very reason for Yahweh's vengeance is the controversy of Zion. The word Zion in prophecy represents the mountain of the people of Yahweh, and the Jews are not Zion. Rather, they, along with the Arabs, are the children of the ancient Edomites and Canaanites. Now we shall read a similar prophecy in Obadiah. Contrary to the lies of the Talmudic rabbis who claim an early date of authorship for Obadiah, and associate him with the man of that name who lived in the time of Ahab and Jezebel. Some Christians follow the Jewish interpretation and some don't. Some realize that Obadiah was much later. The prophet could not have written until after the destruction of Jerusalem and the Babylonian captivity. Perhaps he wrote as late as the Second Temple period, but that cannot be determined with certainty. However, where in verse 7 we read, "All the men of thy confederacy have brought thee even to the border. The men that were at peace with thee have deceived thee and prevailed against thee." We see an allusion to the Assyrians and Babylonians with whom the Edomites had allied themselves. In the 137th Psalm, which was written in the captivity, we read, "Remember, O Yahweh, the children of Edom in the day of Jerusalem, who said, raise it, even to the foundation thereof." So it was the Edomites who were at least a major factor in the complete leveling of ancient Jerusalem. Then in 1 Esdras chapter 4, we read in verse 45, and 1 Esdras is a much better copy of the book from the Masoretic text that we know as Ezra. It's just not available in Hebrew, only in Greek. "Thou hast also vowed to build up the temple, which the Edomites burned when Judea was made desolate by the Chaldees," meaning the Babylonians. So the Edomites burned the temple, according to Ezra, writing 100 years later or so. So the Edomites had an active role in the destruction of Judah and of Solomon's temple. And a little further on in Obadiah, we read, "For thy violence against thy brother Jacob, shame shall cover thee, and thou shalt be cut off forever. In the day that thou stoodest on the other side, in the day that the strangers carried away captive his forces, and foreigners entered into his gates, and cast lots upon Jerusalem, even thou wast one of them." So that establishes that Obadiah was writing after the destruction of Jerusalem and the Second Temple, and the captivity of Judah, sometime after. We can't tell exactly how long after. But once we realize when it was that Obadiah was written, we must understand that, like Isaiah chapter 34, his prophecy against Edom is not yet fulfilled. At no time since the Old Kingdom, or the failed attempts of the Maccabees to drive the Edomites out of Judea before they began converting them instead, have any of the children of Israel destroyed the Edomites, of whom are today's Jews. The only exception is the destruction of Jerusalem by the Romans and the subsequent wars with the Jews, but that is a subject of other prophecies, and neither did that destroy all of Jewry. And to destroy all the Edomites, you'd probably have to destroy all of the Arabs as well, because many of them are Arabs. So later in Obadiah, in a prophecy parallel to that which we read from Isaiah chapter 34, the prophet describes the wrath of Yahweh. "For the day of Yahweh is near upon all the nations, as thou hast done." This is the same language that we see in the fall of Babylon. "As thou hast done, it shall be done unto thee. Thy reward shall return upon thine own head. For as ye have drunk upon my holy mountain, so shall all the heathen drink continually. Yea, they shall drink, and they shall swallow down, and they shall be as though they had not been. This is the judgment of the goats, of all of the beasts who have been living in Christian lands and feeding off of the white Europeans who had established their societies. Upon their judgment, they shall be as though they had never existed. Then, as the prophet continues, but upon Mount Zion shall be deliverance, and there shall be holiness, and the house of Jacob shall possess their possessions. Lots of big screen TVs and Nikes and old Cadillacs, I guess. And the house of Jacob shall be a fire, and the house of Joseph a flame, and the house of Esau for stubble. And they shall kindle in them and devour them, and there shall not be any remaining of the house of Esau, for Yahweh has spoken it. This is the violence of the lambs, the role which the children of Israel shall have in the vengeance of Yahweh against his enemies. But in this context, it also becomes apparent that Edom is responsible for the fate of all these nations which had been feeding themselves off of the children of Israel. And Edom being world Jewry, we should plainly see in modern history just how that role is fulfilled. That same phenomenon is described in different terms in Revelation chapter 20, where it is Satan, another label for world Jewry, who gathers all of the nations against the camp of the saints. Parallel to these prophecies in Isaiah and Obadiah is a passage in Micah chapter 4, to which we have already referred several times in the course of this commentary on the Revelation, beginning in chapter 12. So we shall only read from the end of the chapter, from verse 10. Be in pain, and labor to bring forth, O daughter of Zion, like a woman in travail. For now shalt thou go forth out of the city, and thou shalt dwell in the field, and thou shalt even go to Babylon. There shalt thou be delivered. There Yahweh shall redeem thee from the hand of thine enemies. In this passage, the children of Israel are described as going to Babylon, an allegory which was made at the beginning of their captivity. But they are not in the city. Rather, they are out in the field. Now in a revelation, the children of Israel are delivered by coming out of mystery Babylon. So the allegory of the prophet indicates for us that the words are referring to the same process of deliverance and redemption which we see here in these chapters of the revelation, a process of the punishment and ultimate salvation of Israel, which began with the ancient captivities and which we await the culmination And we await the culmination of that process today. Now Micah informs us of the same circumstances which we see described of Israel in Isaiah chapter 34, Obadiah, Ezekiel chapters 38 and 39, and Revelation chapter 20, where we read in verse 11, Now also many nations are gathered against thee, that say, Let her be defiled, and let our eye look upon Zion. This was not written in relation to ancient Israel and Judah. Rather, it is clear from the context provided throughout the chapter that it speaks of Israel in the last days, after the captivities, where the word of Yahweh had already said in verse 1 of that chapter, But in the last days it shall come to pass that the mountain of the house of Yahweh shall be established in the top of the mountains, and it shall be exalted above the hills, and people shall flow into it. Then further on, in verses 6 and 7, there is a description of what will become of Israel in captivity. In that day, saith Yahweh, will I assemble her that halted, and I will gather her that is driven out, and her that I have afflicted, and I will make her that halted a remnant, and her that was cast far off a strong nation, and Yahweh shall reign over them in Mount Zion from henceforth even forever. So the time of Micah chapter 4, verse 11 must be this time. It can't be anything in the distant past. Continuing the last verses of Micah chapter 4, where all nations are gathered against scattered Israel in the last days, where they all want to defile Zion. But they know not the thoughts of Yahweh, neither understand they his counsel. For he shall gather them as the sheaves into the floor. Arise and thresh, O daughter of Zion, for I will make thine horn iron, and I will make thy hoofs brass, and thou shalt beat in pieces many people, and I will consecrate their gain unto Yahweh, and their substance unto the Lord of the whole earth. This is, again, the violence of the lambs, and now there are several prophetic and apostolic witnesses to the fact that in the day of the wrath of Yahweh, the children of Israel who had turned to obedience to him shall indeed have a share in his vengeance when it is executed upon his enemies. As we have said, that violence shall be a just and righteous violence because it is from God. In the New Testament, the children of Israel are described as the body of Christ, and especially in the epistles of Paul. With this in mind, we find the violence of the lambs expressed once again in the 118th Psalm, which is a messianic prophecy for his second advent and a prayer which all Israel should utter today. O give thanks unto Yahweh, for he is good, because his mercy endures forever. I called upon Yahweh in distress. Yahweh answered me and set me in a large place. Yahweh is on my side. I will not fear. What can man do unto me? Yahweh takes my part with them that help me. Therefore shall I see my desire upon them that hate me. It is better to trust in Yahweh than to put confidence in man. It is better to trust in Yahweh than to put confidence in princes. The children of Israel are now set in a large place, but we should interpret this last line as an indication that there is no political solution to our woes. Now continuing with the psalm from verse 10. All nations compass me about, but in the name of Yahweh I will destroy them. They compass me about, yeah, they compass me about, but in the name of Yahweh I will destroy them. They compass me about like bees. They are quenched as the fire of thorns. For in the name of Yahweh I will destroy them. The I representing the body of Christ, which is also the children of Israel collectively. This also describes the violence of the lambs. Now, where it continues, the enemies are briefly addressed in verse 13. Thou hast thrust sore at me that I might fall, but Yahweh helped me. Yahweh is my strength and song, and is become my salvation. And skipping ahead a little to verse 17. I shall not die, but live, and declare the works of Yahweh. Yahweh has chastened me sore, but he has not given me over unto death. David speaking for all Israel. I'm sorry, my throat is very dry and raspy today, I guess. We had passed over a few verses which offered further praise for Yahweh. Now, at the end of the psalm, it becomes evident that this is indeed a messianic prophecy in verse 22. The stone which the builders refused is become the headstone of the corner, the chief cornerstone. This is Yahweh's doing. It is marvelous in our eyes. The builders are those original Israelites who had demanded an earthly king, sinfully rejecting Yahweh as their king. 1 Samuel chapter 8. Now there is more to the psalm, but we will only read two more verses in relation to Christ as king. This is the day which Yahweh has made. We will rejoice and be glad in it. Save now, I beseech thee, O Yahweh, I beseech thee, send now prosperity. The day it references is evidently the day of his wrath, when the enemies are destroyed by the body of Christ, in which all the other nations that came against Israel are also destroyed. And as it says in Obadiah, they shall be as though they had never been. Right now, today, people argue over whether there was a Holocaust, or they argue over whether there was a Jesus. But the day is coming when people will argue over whether or not there were ever really any Jews. That day is coming. Or any niggers, or chinks, or spigs, or any other kind of squat monster or half-breed. In that same manner, Revelation chapter 17 also continues. And I saw one messenger. The Codex Sinaiticus has another messenger. I've been sort of skipping over the variations in the text this evening. There's some that I wanted to read, but they're not that important. And this is a longer than usual presentation, or so I think it might be. And I saw one messenger standing on the sun, and he cried out with a great voice, saying, to all of the birds flying in midair, or mid-heaven, if you will, come, gather to the great dinner of Yahweh, in order that you may eat the flesh of the kings and the flesh of the commanders, and the flesh of the mighty, and the flesh of the horses, and of those sitting upon them, and the flesh of all, both free and slaves, and small and great. Now, I have to make an admission. Preparing for this commentary, I had two humbling experiences. First, I noted an error in the transcription of Matthew chapter 25, verse 45, in the Christogenean New Testament, which is far too removed to sort out, but which is now corrected. I don't know where the text came from that's in there. It's not ever the way I understood the verse. But then, beginning the preparation for this commentary earlier this week, I discovered that these two verses that I just read, verses 17 and 18, are completely missing from the 2011 commentary. An error which is previously undiscovered, or at least had never been reported to me by any reader. And that's a long time, and unfortunately, quite a few books. Again, I must apologize for my errors, and I certainly will make more, but I cannot apologize for being a mere man and prone to mistakes, and the experience is always humbling, to say the least. It really is, but I'm going to make mistakes. Even in my early days of study in prison, I knew I was going to make mistakes, and I joked with Clifton that I prayed, and I was really only half joking, that I prayed that I would be the one to catch my mistakes. So this mistake, I guess I was. Nobody ever told me that these verses were missing in my 2011 commentary on the revelation of Yahshua Christ, and that book sold, I don't know how many copies, probably a few thousand. So, no, it didn't sell millions, that's for sure. I wish it would. I would raise the price of it to a penny above cost if I knew that it would sell millions, because I would want it to, right? But no, that's not going to happen. The vision of the birds flying in midair are being called to eat the flesh of the enemies of Yahweh evokes the words of Christ in Matthew chapter 24. There, in answer to his statement concerning the coming destruction of the temple, the apostles had asked him several questions, where we read, then with his sitting upon the Mount of Olives, the students came forth to him by themselves, saying, tell us, when shall these things be? And what is the sign of your coming and of the consummation of the age? Then, later in a chapter, in relation to the last of these questions, we read, for just as lightning comes out from the east and appears so far as the west, thusly shall be the coming of the Son of Man. Wherever the corpse may be, there the eagles are gathered. Or I should say, there the eagles shall be gathered. The corpse must also be a reference to the fallen state of the children of Israel, the remnants of the whore who had joined herself to the beast. And as Revelation chapter 18 affirms, those who do not hear the call to come out of Babylon shall be punished along with the enemies. Come out of Babylon, lest ye suffer her punishments. There is another vision of Israel in captivity in Isaiah chapter 41. Within the context of Isaiah, the last 26 chapters, beginning with 41, were written after the Assyrian deportations of Israel and most of Judah, and the end of the failed siege against Jerusalem, which left King Hezekiah and the inhabitants of the city. So these verses may be applicable to the events following the captivities of Israel, but it is not limited to that time, and it continues today. But now, Israel, art my servant, Jacob, whom I have chosen, the seed of Abraham, my friend, thou whom I have taken from the ends of the earth and called thee from the chief men thereof, and said unto thee, thou art my servant, I have chosen thee, and not cast thee away. Fear thou not, for I am with thee. Be not dismayed, for I am thy God. I will strengthen thee. Yeah, I will help thee. Yeah, I will uphold thee with the right hand of my righteousness. Behold, all that were incensed against thee shall be ashamed and confounded. They shall be as nothing, just as we saw in Obadiah. And they that strive with thee shall perish. Thou shalt seek them and shall not find them. There are some white folk that will be looking for their nigger football stars after this is fulfilled and won't find them. I'm sorry I'm making a joke, but people today, they need to be mocked. They really do. Thou shalt seek them and shalt not find them, even them that contended with thee. They that war against thee shall be as nothing, as a thing of naught. For I, Yahweh thy God, will hold thy right hand, saying unto thee, fear not, I will help thee. Fear not, thou worm Jacob. And ye men of Israel, I will help thee, saith Yahweh, and thy Redeemer, the Holy One of Israel. By worm, perhaps remnant is the underlying meaning of the allegory. Now, in language similar to that of Micah chapter 4, where the violence of the lambs is also evident, we read, behold, I will make thee a new sharp threshing instrument having teeth. Thou shalt thresh the mountains and beat them small, and shalt make the hills as chaff. Thou shalt fan them, and the wind shall carry them away, and the whirlwind shall scatter them. And thou shalt rejoice in Yahweh, and shalt glory in the Holy One of Israel. So we see a lot of similarities in the language of this passage in Isaiah with Micah and Obadiah. Verse 19 of Revelation chapter 19. And I saw the beast and the kings of the earth and their armies gathered to make war with him sitting upon the horse and with his army. In Revelation chapter 20, this same phenomenon shall be explained from a different perspective as Satan, who gathers all of the nations, therein described as Gog and Magog, from the four corners of the earth to come against the camp of the saints. But this same thing is also described in Ezekiel chapters 38 and 39. Where Gog and Magog are included in a gathering of many nations against the mountains of Israel, and there is much similar language there with both Revelation chapters 19 and 20, which we shall reserve for our commentary for that later chapter. Here we shall only state that the armies which fight against Christ and his army, that these are not necessarily literal armies in the traditional military sense of the word. But we shall only say that while we cannot rule out a literal military invasion of the nations of Christendom by armed hordes of the enemy races, we can't rule that out. It is not necessary in order to fulfill the words of these prophecies. It is evident in modern times that the nations of the children of Israel are already overrun by all of the other races. And each day they become even more overrun with them, as the dragon has made war with the woman under the pretense of peace. Verse 20. And he seized the beast, and with him the false prophet, who had been making signs before him, by which he deceived those having received the inscribed mark of the beast and who worshipped his image. These two are cast alive into the lake of fire, burning with sulfur. And those remaining were slain by the sword of him sitting upon the horse, which came from out of his mouth, and all the birds ate their fill from their flesh. The references to birds in verses 17 and 21 may be interesting. They may be people and not actual birds. People descended from the fallen angels, perhaps. As in Ezekiel chapter 39, the hordes of the enemy turn on each other, which we will explain, hopefully, in our next presentation. But sometimes it seems to refer to literal birds. Likewise, in Ezekiel chapter 39, where we read where Yahweh tells the hordes of the enemy that thou shalt fall upon the mountains of Israel, thou and all thy bands and the people that is with thee. I will give thee unto the ravenous birds of every sort and to the beasts of the field to be devoured. And that seems to be speaking of literal animals. So, it's not always an allegory. Of course, the beast is not a literal individual, and neither is the false prophet. The beast is the world system which comprises the global, mercantile, political, and religious system, and the banks and corporations which are its arms, or perhaps its heads. The beast is a global manifestation of all former world empires, as we had seen in Revelation chapter 17. Then, since it is the dragon which gives its power to the beast, as it is stated in Revelation chapter 13, world Jewry and the international Jewish banking and mercantile families have given their power to form this modern beast. The Pope is a false prophet, but so are all the rabbis of Judaism, the imams of Islam, every Orthodox and Roman Catholic bishop and priest. They're all false prophets. And all other proponents of every other religion, they're all false prophets, every single one of them. Moreover, throughout every institution in the West today, there are found beasts and false prophets. The entire media is replete with false prophets, and every so-called think tank, every philosopher, nearly every university professor, and every politician is a false prophet. So the beast and the false prophet cannot represent particular individuals, but rather they must represent aspects of the overall social structure of the modern world and its many institutions. Anyone who merely repeats those things which the beast has promoted is a false prophet and a mouthpiece for the beast. The birds shall eat their fill from the flesh of every last one of them. Notice here that it does not state that those who take the mark of the beast are cast into the lake of the fire. Rather, only those who have deceived them into taking the mark are cast in, who are represented by the label of false prophet. As we read in Revelation chapter 14 of those who took the mark, and another, third messenger, followed them, saying with a great voice, if one worships the beast and its image, and receives an engraved mark upon his forehead, or upon his hand. Then he shall drink from the wine of the wrath of Yahweh, which is poured unmixed into the cup of his anger, and he shall be tormented in fire and sulfur before the holy messengers and before the Lamb. And the smoke of their torment ascends for the eternal ages, and they who worship the beast and its image, and one who receives the engraved mark of its name, shall not have rest day and night. But even that does not mean that those who took the mark are cast into the lake of fire. Rather, we interpret this to mean that they are punished in this life, and the memory of that punishment lasts forever. Later in Revelation chapter 20, we see that in addition to the beast and the false prophet, whosoever was not found written in the book of life was cast into the lake of fire. This is a different group entirely and must represent goat nations, as Christ had explained in Matthew chapter 25, that their fate is the same as that fire which is reserved for the devil and his angels. But on the other hand, the revelation also informs us that the names of those who would accept the mark of the beast, their names are not written into the book of the life of the Lamb. That's in Revelation chapter 13. And all that dwell upon the earth shall worship him, whose names are not written in the book of life of the Lamb from the foundation of the world. So it seems that perhaps from that passage, those who worship the beast are those, and those who take the mark of the beast are those whose names are not written in the book of life, which would be only the goat nations. These, and I will go into this again when we present Revelation chapter 20, these are seemingly conflicts. But once we understand the time and place of each of these mentions of the Book of Life and the Mark of the Beast on the historic scale of the fulfillment of these prophecies, then there should be no conflicts. This concludes our commentary for Revelation chapter 19. However, we shall continue with the same subject in the parallel portions of Revelation chapter 20, although that chapter is broader in scope as it introduces different aspects of the punishment and salvation and ultimate salvation of the children of Israel. Thank you for listening. Praise Yahweh, the God of Israel, and good night.